You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 8th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, friends. How are
Hello,
you?
Hello, everybody.
Great. Super.
Made it to our second show of 2014.
New record.
Year's going well.
Yeah, this is the furthest into 2014 we've ever recorded.
Steve, why is it true that eating beans gives you bad gas? Why does this happen?
is that empirical gas? Knowledge really? That you're imparting to us, Jay?
Particularly in the past 24 hours, yes.
We're doing this.
Unreal.
Gas is not bad.
Oh, my God.
So, talking about you specifically or humanity in general?
In general, though, why is it known that beans cause gas? What's wrong with them?
Yeah, well, it's due to bacterial fermentation. The bacteria digest and ferment the carbohydrates in the beans that you yourself cannot digest. And that process produces the gas.
So the bacteria in my gut love beans and they're farting. It's not actually me.
No, well, they're producing gas that you are then farting.
Yeah, you have to expel it somehow.
So I'm just a big anus for the bacteria in my gut.
You are a gas factory,
That's
yes.
One way to put it.
Mm-hmm. You're doing Super. Your job swimmingly, by the way.
Rebecca, happy 2014.
Jay, how old are you? Jay, how old are you? I'm 45.
I'm 45.
I'm still farty far.
Okay, so on January 11th, 1935, Amelia Earhart became the first person to fly solo from Hawaii to California.
Cool.
Wow. She That's did it in less awesome. Than 12 parsecs.
A lot of people had tried it before and failed, but she did it, and it was a smooth ride.
They tried
Everything
and failed.
Everything went fine.
Tried and died.
Thank you, Jay.
What?
Any listener wants to name the quote from what movie, and you get the Geek Award.
You get one official nerd point if you get that quote, yeah.
Great. Now we're going to get a flood of emails saying stupid things I don't care about.
Rebecca, do we know how many people tried before she did?
837.
Wow. And
no, I don't. You made that up. I don't know. I just made that up.
Much like Jay's gas that came right out of your butt.
But
Jay's gas does not come out my butt, just to be clear.
We are close, but not quite that close. So a lot of people did try and failed, and then she just came in and kicked ass.
Yeah, that's what she did. She was an ass kicker. Until, of course, her famous flight where she disappeared. Attempting a solo trip around the world. Is that what she was doing?
No, it wasn't solo. She had a navigator with her.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
But before that happened, though, she did do a lot of other things. She was the first female to win the Air Force Distinguished Flying Cross. And this one surprised me. Only 1 year after Lindbergh's flight, she was the first woman to make the flight across the Atlantic Ocean. Now, she wasn't the pilot. She was checking maps and keeping recordings. And she kind of disparaged that achievement, though, saying that she felt like baggage. But in 1932, which I think was like 3 years later, she did become the first woman to fly alone across the Atlantic Ocean. So lots of achievements for her.
That's awesome.
She was also one of the people who formed the 99s, which was and still is, I think, an organization for female pilots.
Do you guys know that so on her final trip, which she did make with a navigator, Fred Noonan, that she was traveling from west to east. So she started in Miami and she actually made 22,000 miles of her journey and only had 7,000 miles left, the last leg essentially, which was across the Pacific Ocean. The consensus now is that she and her navigator screwed up basically. They didn't bring the right radio equipment along. Ooh. And they were aiming for a tiny island called Howland Island. And they probably just missed it because they weren't navigating properly, because they were using the wrong kind of equipment. And
Well, not necessarily the wrong kind of equipment. What I've read is that it was brand new equipment that they didn't have much experience with.
Yes, they did not have experience with it. So I'm reading off the Navy site, which is saying that this is the U.S. Navy Operations Archive, that they were using the wrong frequencies. Because of lack of experience.
Yeah. They just didn't know how to use it. And it was brand new technology that nobody had really used before, which makes it probably a poor choice for a trip like that. But
And then so they just ran out of fuel. You know, you miss your target, you get a big ocean, just run out of fuel, and that was it. Yeah.
Was Howland Island part of the original flight plan?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. She didn't have to.
That was her next stop. She just missed it.
Mm.
That must be scary. You're running out of fuel and something about blue water as far as the eye could see everywhere. You know,
talk about panic.
Yeah.
Awful.
And because they've never found the wreckage, there are tons of conspiracy theories and stuff about what happened to them and ghostly things, Bermuda Triangle-esque theories, but so far none of those have panned out.
Steve, I don't think, I mean, that's just the most likely reason, right? I mean, they don't really have solid evidence that they screwed up.
It's inferred from the evidence we do have, the last radio contact, et cetera. Yeah, there's no smoking gun, obviously. They never found the plane.
One of my favorite conspiracy theories was that she actually survived and changed her name, assumed a new identity, and went to live in New Jersey under the name Irene Bolam. But that was later proved to be completely false. And poor Irene Bolam is an actual or was an actual person who was flooded with media attention because people were saying that she was actually Amelia Earhart. Why would that happen? I haven't read the book. Maybe the book explains this all. But yeah, Amelia Earhart, just tired of being a famous, awesome hero to the world, decided to fake her own death and move to New Jersey.
Yeah, that's the most implausible part, right?
Yeah. Like, I grew up in New Jersey, okay?
All right. We have an interview coming up with Mark Crislip later in the show. We're going to talk about the Society for Science-Based Medicine. Exciting news. But first, we're going to go on with some news items. Do you guys take multivitamins or any kind of daily vitamins?
No.
Why would I do that?
A Flintstone chewable.
Yeah.
I take fiber and fish oil.
Fiber and fish oil. Oh, that's reasonable. Fish oil is a little bit iffy still, but not unreasonable. So it's a common question that I get. Should I take a multivitamin? What is the evidence, the bottom line evidence about routine supplementation with any specific kind of vitamin or multivitamins in general? Do we need nutritional insurance? You know, what if your diet's not the greatest in the world? Well, over the last few weeks, there were several studies published looking at multivitamin use, all pretty resoundingly negative in terms of there being any benefit from multivitamins. Which is consistent with the last now couple of decades of research looking at routine multivitamin use. One study was looking, this is the long-term multivitamin supplementation and cognitive function in men study, a randomized trial. This looked at physicians age 65 years and older, and they followed them for 12 years. It's a large study, 5,947 male physicians. And they found essentially no benefit to cognition for taking a multivitamin versus a placebo. The weakness of this study is the population. You know, it was men only, and physicians, you know, may have pretty good baseline nutrition. You know, they're certainly not poor. And therefore, you could always say, well, in somebody who is well-nourished at baseline, taking a multivitamin may not have any measurable benefit. But that's kind of the point in saying that you don't need routine supplementation, right? Routine means you don't have any specific reason why you think you would need to take a vitamin, meaning you don't have a known deficiency, you don't have any medical condition or life situation like pregnancy that would require or is known to benefit from certain nutrients or taking supplements.
Yeah, I was going to say this absolutely does not mean don't take prenatal vitamins.
Oh, right. Take your prenatal vitamins. Absolutely. If you have had bariatric surgery, there's evidence to suggest that you may need to take multivitamins. If you're a vegan and are not really careful, you know, you're probably B12 deficient eventually. So, if you have any kind of restrictive diet, you may want to, you know, discuss that with your primary care doctor and get certain vitamin levels checked, for example. But for somebody who has a normal, well-rounded diet, do you need to additionally take multivitamins? This study suggests for cognitive function in elderly men, no. The answer is no measurable benefit. Second study was vitamin and mineral supplementation in the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease and cancer. This looked at multiple trials involving tens of thousands of individuals, and they concluded that there was essentially no significant evidence to support the benefit of vitamins or minerals for the prevention of cancer or cardiovascular disease. Two trials found a small borderline result, but nothing significant, and the other showed no effect. In addition, there was a high-dose oral multivitamin and multimineral trial, oral high-dose multivitamins and minerals after myocardial infarction. This looked at 1,708 patients age 50 and older who had a heart attack and then followed them, you know, with multivitamin or placebo, and again, no benefit.
So no real surprises here to people who have been following the literature on this.
Yeah, it's consistent with the overall pattern in the literature, which is not really any benefit to routine supplementation. I also was digging around to see, you know, if there were other similar trials. For example, there was a systematic review from 2005 looking at multivitamins in the elderly to find out if it prevented infections. And the answer was no. There was essentially, you know, either weak or conflicting evidence. The study results were very, very heterogeneous, which means that the results were scattered. They weren't consistent. So essentially no compelling evidence for any benefit for multivitamins in the elderly. So, and that seems to hold true for pretty much everything they look at. Now, specifically antioxidants, which, you know, I've also wrote about, and I think we've talked about on the show before, but I again sort of just I did an updated search for what's been published just to see what's out there. And recent systematic reviews of antioxidant vitamin specific supplement trials found that there was increased mortality with vitamin
A.
Oh
my God. E?
Vitamin A, beta carotene, and vitamin E. With vitamin C, I think, still being equivocal. So, which is interesting because of all the antioxidant hype, and this discovery was often referred to as the antioxidant paradox. You know, why antioxidants are supposed to be great for you by reducing oxidative stress. The big question is, so why don't vitamins help? Is an interesting question. And what if you have a poor diet? Does taking vitamins help? That question is not directly answered by these studies, but there are other studies which show that, like, for example, in cancer prevention, having a poor diet and taking multivitamins, the multivitamins don't make up for the poor diet. And why not? Why they, you would think that they should. If, what's bad about a poor diet other than malnutrition? Well, it suggests that maybe there is something bad about a poor diet other than malnutrition if just taking vitamins doesn't make up for it. There's a few possibilities here. For antioxidants, and I think also for mega-dosing vitamins, in a word, the answer is homeostasis. In other words, we evolved, you know, over millions of years to have just the right amount of oxidative stress and antioxidants in our body. You know what I mean? That if oxidative stress was so bad, and we have inherent antioxidants in our bodies, you would think that there would be huge evolutionary pressure for just natural antioxidants to just completely get rid of them, you know? But it turns out that our immune systems, for example, use oxidative, you know, free radicals, use oxidative molecules to kill bacteria. You know, it's part of our immune system. And also, it's a marker for metabolism, and it triggers all kinds of other protective measures in cells, like activating heat shock proteins, for example. So if you are just suppressing the oxidative molecules, you may in fact be inhibiting certain parts of the immune system, but also you may be throwing this homeostasis out of whack, and you may be therefore causing unintended negative downstream consequences. One of the things I always mention when I talk about this is, you know, the body's a complex system that evolved to self-regulate, and it's not so easy, you know, to make it function better just by doing something simple, like taking more of something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like a butterfly effect of the body.
Yeah, it's like a web. There's a web of interactions, and you're just pulling on one thread and think that you're going to be able to predict the outcome.
It's actually the opposite of the butterfly effect, because sort of the butterfly effect implies sensitive dependence to initial conditions, which is the opposite. You know, little changes don't make a big difference, which is what you're saying.
Yeah, so the changes are basically absorbed by the system and don't have a big effect, or they have unintended consequences. So yeah,
that's more what I was referring to, is the unintended consequences part, not the no consequences.
But Bob
part.
Is right. The homeostasis is kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, in a self-regulating system, it tends to bring itself back, you know, to balance, and it's hard to nudge it out of that. And if you try to do it by, like, every day taking antioxidants and, you know, pushing it in one direction, that's where you get the unintended consequences. So also it's possible that there are aspects of a poor diet that aren't fixed by taking supplements. For example, especially in a Western diet, the problem may be more about what we're overeating, not what we're undereating. So eating like lots of fruits and vegetables correlates with, you know, better health, lower heart disease and lower cancer risk, but not eating steak and taking a vitamin, you know. So it's not just the vitamins and minerals we're getting in the fruits and vegetables. It's got to also be maybe either there's something else there or like fiber or whatever, or it's that if you're eating lots of fruits and vegetables, you're not eating as much animal fat. So the bottom line recommendation for multivitamins is if you are healthy, you don't have any specific nutritional needs because of a disease or, again, something like pregnancy, you're better off just having a well-rounded diet and making sure you're eating your vegetables, basically. And you shouldn't think that you're compensating for not having a healthy diet by taking multivitamins, because the evidence suggests that you're not. If you have any questions about whether or not you're getting enough of particular vitamins, or, you know, maybe you might be low for whatever reason, the best thing to do is just have your levels checked. It's really easy. Just, you know, discuss it with your primary care doctor. We check vitamin levels routinely. After low, then you supplement what you need. You know, that's
or make a diet change. I mean, get into the habit. Find some vegetables, you know, fruits and vegetables that you like, and just build them into your routine. You know, yeah. Sometimes in order to take care of yourself, you have to go through some pain. That's life.
I don't consider eating vegetables pain, but
well, some people do though, Steve.
Yeah,
it's serious.
Perry used to.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
We mentioned pregnancy vitamins earlier, and I wanted to take a moment to point out the fact that I'm not pregnant.
Okay.
But Indre Viscontis, who was on our show just a few weeks ago, just had her very first baby boy, and he is healthy and happy and. Everybody has just gone home from the hospital.
Yay, folic acid.
Congratulations.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Okay, Bob, you're going to tell us why it's so damn cold.
Oh, man.
How cold is it?
And if you guys have been watching the news, frigid temperatures have been all over the news lately. And if you've been...
What do you mean watching the news? You just have to wake up in the morning.
Well, I mean, I'm
for 90% of the country.
I know, but everyone's talking about it. And if you've been following it, I'm sure you've probably heard the term polar vortex at least 50 times. And if it weren't such a cool term, I think I'd be pretty sick of it by now. This has been such a huge news item for the first 2 weeks of 2014, and I wanted to explore why it's been so hellishly cold and exactly what a polar vortex is. Now, if I have some time, I'd like to comment also on why this can happen on a planet that is supposed to be experiencing global warming. You know, I know, but it has to be said. People are still spouting nonsense about this. So, cold, just saying it's been cold, of course, is an understatement. Temperatures deep in the negatives, both Fahrenheit and Celsius. Dozens of cities in the U.S. broke records for January 7th. Surprisingly, there weren't a lot of overall, like, coldest records ever in any cities, really. It's really a lot of records were broken just for that specific day of the year, January 7th. So that was a little bit of a surprise, considering how damn cold it was. Some saw wind chills as low as minus 30, 40, and in the 50s. And my favorite observations include the fact that Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo apparently kept its polar bear inside during the worst of it, which is funny. Aww. And the other one I liked was that some cities were apparently colder than Mars. Now, of course, I had to investigate this. And so there are some caveats. The polar bear, that specific polar bear, does not have a layer of fat that wild polar bears have. So keeping him inside, you know, it's not as dramatic as it seems, and probably just a really sensible precaution considering that. And regarding Mars, though, you know, perhaps there were some cities that were colder than Mars, but only if you consider the absolute warmest places on Mars itself. On average, of course, Mars is way colder. We're talking, you know, minus 170, minus 200. I mean, it's crazy cold.
It's worth remembering that Mars is an entire planet. So it's like saying right. Colder than Earth. What does that mean exactly? I know.
But it is interesting to note that the coldest places on Earth can be colder than the warmest places on Mars. That the temperatures overlap. That's kind of fun.
Yeah. But you got to keep it in perspective a little bit.
Yeah.
So regardless though, it's been colder than it's been in decades. And so I wanted to find out, you know, what the hell is going on and what exactly is a polar vortex? So essentially a polar vortex is a persistent frigid hurricane over the Earth's poles. That's pretty much it right there. It's a rotating low pressure system, and they're usually there hanging out. You know, most times of the year, this vortex will be there. And sometimes little pieces of the vortex will descend onto the U.S. and making it, you know, colder than usual a bit. But this year was clearly very different. That's not what happened. Polar vortex this winter has been unusually strong, keeping all the polar air locked up tight. The longer this happens, the colder the air actually gets. So it's been this way for, I would assume, most of the winter. And it's been locked up so tight that it just gets colder and colder, which wasn't totally intuitive to me, but that's apparently what happens. So what happened recently then is that the air current suddenly weakened. And this is what allowed this huge chunk of the vortex to break free and kind of descend on the United States. And this is called either a negative Arctic collision or a polar vortex collapse. Now, so this explains this, you know, in a nutshell, you know, the bitter cold that we've been experiencing and that northern Florida has been cursing, I assume, since it's been pretty cold in the panhandle.
Oh, those poor things.
But, yeah. So why?
What's it like? Was it like 45?
I know it's hard to find sympathy. So why did it go so deep? And that's because this cold air mass is just so big and so dense, right? Colder air is denser, and so you have this dense, really fluid like substance that just spills out, and it just keeps going. It won't stop, and that's why it just kept going all the way south. So now a lot of people are asking, doesn't this disprove climate change or global warming? I mean, we get this every winter, right? So I say, read a damn science book. Climate is different from weather. Hello. A climate change actually means that the intensity and frequency of extreme cold events will go down on average, but extreme weather events will still happen. They're not going away, and they could be extreme cold events or extreme hot events. You know, they're still going to happen. It's just the frequency and the intensity will change as the world gets warmer on average. So that said, this was interesting. It's also important to note, I think, that there may be a connection between this polar vortex event and global warming itself. They may be connected. You know, there's been a lot of news lately about, the decrease in Arctic sea ice and the decrease in the amount of snow. And that all means that there's less reflected light. There's less evaporation, et cetera. So this could potentially weaken the polar vortex, which is exactly why it spilled over onto the United States, because of that weakening. And there might be a connection there. They've kind of seen some tantalizing hints of a connection, but I just want to stress that this is by no means definitive, and climatologists and meteorologists aren't agreeing on this yet, but we may, you know, have a much stronger link in a few years. I did want to end, though, with some funny suggestions that people have made to rename the polar vortex for some reason, and maybe see if we can come up with some good ones as well. I came across a bunch of these here that were interesting. Attack of the Arctic, the second coming of the frost monster. Nah, that's not bad. Lip chapping cyclone of doom. That wasn't too bad. My favorite was hell flakes. That was pretty funny. Ice apocalypse and blizzard krieg. I thought that was kind of funny.
That's kind of clever, but yeah. Polar vortex is just an awesome phrase.
I know.
Phrase.
I love
can't
it.
Beat
I wouldn't,
that.
I wouldn't change it, but let me throw
if I were starting
after.
A band right now, it would
yes.
be called polar vortex.
Yes, right? There you go. Two more. That thing from the day after tomorrow, which of course it wasn't, because that was insane. What was that? If that thing was like 100 minus 180 or 200, it was just like not going to happen on the Earth. And then
Art Bell novel.
Yeah. And the last one, what the Starks were warning us about. Of course, there had to be a Game of Thrones reference.
I got
in there.
A better one, Bob.
What do you got? What do you got, Jay?
I don't know what it is, but it's cold and pissed off.
I love it. It's my second favorite.
That's
Jay,
cute.
Awesome, dude.
All right. Well, we're going to shift from talking about the polar vortex to talking about earthquakes. Rebecca, you got an update for us on why we sometimes see pretty lights around earthquakes.
Yeah. Speaking of rare events, would have been a better segue.
Oh, now you're critiquing my segues?
I'm just saying.
Now.
There is a rare phenomenon surrounding earthquakes, which I had actually not heard before. But it is something that has resulted apparently in so-called UFO sightings and various conspiracy theories. And it is the appearance of lights before earthquakes. Have you guys heard of this
yeah.
before?
Yeah, about an hour ago.
It's been noticed for quite some time. It's been on the books at least for decades. Lights that pop up and they're described in various ways, things like a 4-inch blue flame hovering around ankle level on the ground, or things more resembling what we know as ball lightning, that kind of hovering plasma light. And always preceding by some hours or minutes, sometimes during the event, but an earthquake. And so a researcher has just published a paper, several researchers, I should say, one of whom, Friedman Freund, who is a physicist and a senior researcher at Ames Research Center at NASA. They've published a paper suggesting that there is a real basis for these lights that occur before earthquakes, that it's not just things that people are imagining. It's not just birds or planes or, you know, some other thing that people are just falsely associating with the earthquake, that they are actual lights that are appearing before earthquakes. And they've done a bit of research into it and come up with a possible explanation for what it is. What they're suggesting is that these are actual bits of plasma, bits of electric charge that are activated when earthquakes begin to put heavy stress on certain types of rock, particularly basalts and gabbros, which have quartz crystals in them with imperfections that they say lend themselves to this kind of effect. There are some areas where these particular type of rocks are found in these vertical sort of spikes called dikes. No jokes, please. That go very deep down into the ground, as much as 60 miles underground. Whoa. And wow. What they're suggesting...
Dikes go deep.
Yeah. Yes, they do. What they're suggesting is that the pressure put on these dikes underground, the dikes act as a kind of funnel that bring the electrical charge straight up to the surface sometimes. And it kind of explodes out over the surface of the earth into a plasma-like, high-velocity electrical charge that can take a variety of forms, like a variety of colors and shapes and intensities. This is their hypothesis. This is I think the first time that this has been suggested as a possibility for these lights. So I think it's the sort of thing where, it's going to need a lot more research to figure out if this is so. The researchers are talking about actually trying to recreate the lights in a laboratory setting, cool. Which would be kind of awesome. Yeah. But it is pretty convincing. There are, over the past few decades, the evidence that these lights exist has built up more and more and more, mostly thanks to the preponderance of cameras, security mm-hmm. cameras and things like that. Exactly what we expect of other phenomena like Bigfoot. Say, as cameras become the sort of thing where you carry three around on your person at all times, it's expected that rare phenomena will be captured on camera more and more often. So oftentimes, as skeptics, we look at things that seem or that people suggest are supernatural in origin, like ghosts and Bigfoot and things like that. We say, well, where's your evidence? There should be much better evidence now that there are more cameras. Well, this is one instance of something that seemed like it might have been something that people who believe in the paranormal would really get behind. This is an example of something that, because of the instance of cameras increasing, has actually shown to be true. So yeah, there have been, the researchers had a lot of photographic evidence to look at and to compare to the exact times of and locations of earthquakes. And so yeah, this is an example of a phenomena that even earthquake researchers, many of them, dismiss this as something that people, that was just in people's heads. But these researchers have presented some really compelling evidence to suggest that it is not, in fact, just in their heads, and that it might have a really very interesting natural source. So would this be something that you could use to predict earthquakes? Probably not, say the researchers, because it's a very rare phenomenon.
Like one in every 200 earthquakes.
Due to the locations of these exact types of minerals. And also, I'd imagine just the timing of the lights, you know, it'd be, I don't know, kind of tricky to see and to log in time to do anything about it. The researchers do suggest that this is one possible symptom of an upcoming earthquake that could be used to help predict an earthquake. And they give a few examples of people who saw the lights, heard the stories about the lights predicting earthquakes, and used that information to protect themselves before earthquakes arrived. So, you know, if you see some dancing balls of light, or sometimes they said it could look like actual lightning flashes, maybe crawl under a heavy, well-made table.
Ready.gov website says you should get under a sturdy table.
Ah.
Yeah. So is a door jam going to help in any way?
Stay away from glass windows, outside doors, and walls, or anything that could fall.
But yeah, I think inside doors are supposed to be good because of the door jam.
If you're in bed, stay in bed. Cover your head with a pillow. Don't use a doorway unless you know it's load-bearing, sturdy doorway.
Ah.
Do not use elevators. That's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So
invoke deity of your choice.
Rebecca, we should mention that the effect they're talking about here is the piezoelectric effect, which we've mentioned before on the show.
Well, but it's not.
Here we go again.
According to the researchers, and I've had some difficulty. I spent some time trying to figure out exactly what the difference was, but I've read specifically that the researchers say that this is not the piezoelectric effect, which is, of course, you know, just the idea of putting pressure on something like a quartz and it generating electricity from that. I suspect that the reason why they're saying that is just because it's slightly more complex.
Well, it's not just the piezoelectric effect. It's the combination of that with this conduit that concentrates it and brings it up to the surface.
Right.
But the generation of the electricity, that's the definition of the piezoelectric effect.
I know. I'm just saying, like, this is what I've read, is that they're saying that it is, like, not.
Like
that
not.
It is some, like, an entirely different electrical process is what I've read. But I have not been able to figure out exactly.
I had the same problem, Rebecca. It was very ambiguous and vague. And like, it's not my story. I'll let Rebecca handle it because I couldn't figure it out either.
Maybe one of our listeners can shed some more light on that.
Okay. Well, we are covering some classic topics this week. Evan, you're going to tell us about the guy who claims that he shot and killed Bigfoot. Evan, you're a Bigfoot skeptic, right?
I hate this guy.
I am a Bigfoot.
Not Evan.
Oh, thank you for clarifying that. That makes me, reassures me. Absolutely, Steve. It's been in all the newspapers, you know. Just head down to your corner newsstand and give the kid a nickel, you know, the one in the wool cap crying, extra, extra, read all about it. You know, that's how we all get our news nowadays. And you'll pick up the paper and you'll see above the fold, there'll be a headline, read something like this. Man kills Bigfoot and photographs it to prove it. And it says right there that the hunter is claiming that he has shot, I think with a gun, supposedly. It could have been a bow and arrow or a crossbow or something, but shot with a gun and killed Bigfoot in San Antonio, Texas, back in September of 2012. And right there on the page are the photos. It shows exactly the sort of face that the public has been conditioned to think about when thinking about Bigfoot, right?
Slightly more Santa Clausy.
I was thinking it looks like the Abominable Snowman.
Abominable Snowman, I agree. It also looked like that guy who took too much of that silver product, and when his face turned blue, the Smurf Man.
He died
recently.
Of
him too. I know.
So did the guy who played Yukon Cornelius.
Ah,
the Red Nosed Reindeer. Oh, sorry,
that sucks.
I was just thinking about the bumble and
the bumble.
How it kind of looked like a bumble.
I mean, how did they
Abominables bounce?
How did they give this news coverage? I mean, it's so obviously fake. It's pathetic.
It gets worse, Jay. Just wait.
Oh, it gets worse. It always gets worse. So now, what more scientific evidence, gentle listener, do you need than two photographs of a hairy ape looking thing with its eyes shut? And do you know who is making this claim?
Yes, I do.
You know who the person is?
Yeah, we've talked
His
about
name
him.
Is
Dyer.
Rick Dyer.
Does it,
I like how you said that, Bob, from the Better away. Off Dead movie to take
does
off
that
on
guy, Does that name ring a bell? He's a putz that put the costume of Bigfoot from horrordome.com in a freezer. It was a costume. This is that guy.
From yeah, he was one of the two Georgia yep. guys who in
covered
2008.
DNA.
That's right. 2008, a pair of locals in Georgia claimed to have shot and killed a Bigfoot. Right? And they had sold the body to some self-proclaimed scientist for analysis, and there were multiple press conferences surrounding it. A whole media circus ensued for about a month or so. And when it was all over, like you said, Bob, the self-deluded researchers revealed that the body was a rubber and fake fur costume stuffed into a styrofoam cooler with some pig entrails yeah. kind of thrown on top. For
probably
effect.
Not rubber, probably latex, remember, but yeah, you're right.
okay, I'll give you that.
At one point in the video, the guy is in the middle of the woods sitting in a wheelchair without a shirt on. Correct or no?
What?
Yes. Watch the video. Watch
what video
the watch.
Are you watching?
Guys, watch.
There are several newscast videos in which they have taken clips, lots of clips of Rick Dyer from various things. Who knows if it was actually had to do with this specific hunt or not? But Rick Dyer's, you know, out there in the community a lot. There's tons of footage of him doing all sorts of Bigfoot tracking stuff and talking about his
and then
you know adventures and stuff. And yes, you're right, Jay, there is one shot of him at night. Yeah, it does look like he's sitting in a wheelchair and taking a pot shot at something.
And then maybe it's not a wheelchair, it might be like one of those like beach chairs that just kind of looks like a wheelchair. But then there's another scene of him running through the woods in his underwear, and this got on the
Whoa.
News channel. Yes,
you know, I'm starting wow. to like him a little more. Like maybe he's just a troll.
He's a P.T. Barnum. He wants to take it on tour, yeah. charge people a fee to view the body. But I'm sorry, you know, you were found to have committed a Bigfoot hoax. You never get to claim that you found Bigfoot again in your life.
Sorry. Or if you do, mm-hmm. or if you do, like you said, Steve, this guy pulled a huge, stupid hoax years ago. You know, it's say by some crazy coincidence, he really did run into a Bigfoot. And you think he would say, all right, you know, I've got to, no one's going to possibly believe me. I've got to have rock solid evidence. This happened well over a year ago. And just that alone, that was the first sentence I read when I looked at this article. Nearly a year ago, self-described professional Bigfoot hunter, blah, blah. That, you know, if I wasn't lost before I got to the article, that completely ended it because to me, that's pathetic. Mm-hmm. That's utterly pathetic. It's been a year and what he's only released a grainy video and a picture that
I mean,
you know,
but really, like, let's be realistic though. The most pathetic thing about that is self-described professional Bigfoot hunter. Like that is the yeah. most pathetic thing about that.
Bigfoot hoaxer. And this time along, he's making some somewhat bold claims. He says every test that you can possibly imagine was performed on this body: DNA tests, 3D optical scans, body scans,
SATs.
The real deal. You know,
maybe. However, did you notice? And I read a lot of different articles about this story. Not all of them mentioned yeah. his past and how he was an admitted liar.
How could you
liar.
Not mention that? And, I know. I noticed that too. That's a total journalism fail.
Major.
Total fail. It's because they're all wrapped up in Bigfoot culture like the rest of our society, which is why there's 54 different shows on cable television about Bigfoot, and the Dean Cain Bigfoot Bounty Show is coming up that's getting all kinds of press. It's disgusting.
Let's move on. Some good news. We're going to end the news segment with some good news, Jay. Cancer deaths continue to drop.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's hear it for some good news brought to you by science.
Yay, science.
The American Cancer Society each year creates a report that combines data from the National Cancer Institute, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Center for Health Statistics. Ahmed Jamal, the lead author of the study and the vice president for surveillance and health services research at the ACS, reported that the summary of the report is that cancer death rates have been in a steady decline for the past two decades, and they've dropped by approximately 20%. That's 1.3 million lives over the past 20 years. The subgroup that showed the most gain was middle-aged black males. And they studied from 1991 to 2010, and their cancer death-related incidence decreased by 55%, which is pretty significant for a single subgroup. The best way to measure the improvement of cancer treatment is to measure the changes in death rates. And the reason why they really don't consider the number of incidents are there are way too many variables to take into account that they really can't track. The only thing that they can 100% track is the amount of people that are actually dying from some type of cancer or another. So that's why they focus on the death rates only. Now, the rate of cancer deaths has dropped from 215.1 per 100,000 people in 1991 to 171.8 per 100,000 people back in 2010. So this results in 1.34 million prevented cancer deaths over a 20-year period. So these fantastic results can be attributed to the increase in early detection, improved treatment and lifestyle changes, and as an example, smoking has decreased by 50% over the past 50 years. So,
50?
You know, yeah.
That's in the U.S., Jay.
In the U.S., because, yeah.
Worldwide smoking has increased, and in fact, there's a recent report showing that we're just about hit 1 billion people worldwide smoking.
Whoa. A billion? Are you kidding me?
A billion people worldwide.
One out of seven dummies smoke.
Yeah.
The same as the number of people on Facebook. Wow.
Yeah. That's worldwide, but it is decreasing in the U.S.
That is astonishing.
Stay positive. 50% decrease in the past 50 years in the United States. That is largely attributed to the social movement against it. There's been quite a lot of people and money spent to educate people on the dangers of cigarette smoking in the United States, and that's the main reason behind that. But
Jay, the 1964 Surgeon General's report, which really opened the door to reexamining, you know, the whole evidence of the link between smoking and disease,
which
including lung
happens
cancer.
To have yeah, but that was come out today.
Yeah. They're crediting that report with 8 million lives saved.
No, 50 years ago today. And you're right. That's the cultural turnaround point.
Lung, colon, prostate, and breast cancers are the most common, with lung cancer, here you go, Steve, being 0.25% responsible for all cancer deaths. So there's your billion people smoking.
Wait, yeah. Wait, 0.25%?
No, you're just 25%.
Oh. 25%, 0.25% of all cancer deaths are...
Let's just to put this out there, not all people who die of lung cancer or who get lung cancer are smokers or are even in the vicinity of smoke.
That's yeah, but right. The vast majority are. I think. I, for one, feel very happy that one of the major causes of death or early death, I can have a say in just by making conscious changes in the way I live my life.
It does make you feel a little bit better when you can point to a cause that you have control over. But Rebecca's point is valid too, that there are causes that we don't have control over. You know, so we're always walking that fine line. This is with kids or also with health, you know, where you want to encourage positive behavior and good choices without making it seem like you're blaming people when bad things happen. All right, Evan, it's Who's That Noisy time.
It is, and I'm going to play for you right now last week's noisy. Here we go.
Whose fleece was white as snow? Sorry. Okay.
It sounds like somebody playing some type of wind instrument.
Okay, so it's a science experiment. What we have is a fellow who's, you know, in front of a bunch of other people on stage. And what he's done is, you know, he lit a Bunsen burner and took a metal pipe and built in a handle to it. And inside the, you know, the pipe's of, you know, a few inches wide in diameter. Inside the pipe, he stuffed a couple of steel mesh pieces, round pieces, kind of create a little space for the heat to build up. So he holds that over the Bunsen burner. He heats up the metal mesh on the inside for about 10 seconds or so, and then he takes it off and turns it once to the side, turns it back up, straight up and down. Again, this is just a metal cylinder, and it creates noise, heated air. The compression of the air from the heating of the metal inside has to escape and creates that noise that you're hearing. Now, what he also does is he takes another cylinder, slides it over the cylinder containing the air, and it will create, you know, various notes just based on the position of that one cylinder that he slides up and down on the other. You know, trombone. Think of a trombone. Now, the fellow's name is Robert Becker. He teaches chemistry at Kirkwood High School in Kirkwood, Missouri. But what he's known for primarily is giving live demonstrations of chemistry basically in motion and all the cool things you can do in the lab that have to do with chemistry. We had no correct answers this past week.
Oh, really?
A lot of guesses, but no correct answers. A few people thought it was Jimmy Fallon. I guess they felt that he sounded like Jimmy Fallon. Did you guys?
I can kind of
see it.
See that?
Better luck next week, everybody.
Well, what do you got for this week, Evan?
Okay, so here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy? It's a voice you might recognize. Let's see.
I think we run more risks as a people, as a nation, and as a world without a campaign for raising science and critical thinking in Africa.
So there it is. Familiar voice to some, I am sure. But go ahead and give it your best guess. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email address, or post it on the forums, suforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
We're going to do one email this week. This comes from Nick, and Nick writes, I was listening back to episode 336, and one of you guys briefly mentioned not to drink distilled water. Upon doing a quick Google search, I found a lot of conflicting opinions on the subject, and I figured I'd ask my favorite skeptics to clear it up for me. So, is it dangerous or unhealthy to drink distilled water? And if so, why? Thank you very much for your time. I absolutely love and appreciate everything you guys do. All right. Thank you, Nick.
No.
What do you guys think? So, what, Jay, what is distilled water?
Distilled water, well, it's a vague term because there's different ways to distill water and there's different things that you could be distilling out of it. But in essence, it means that you're taking out the impurities, which could be a number of different things like bacteria, minerals. You're demineralizing water, yeah. I think is a more accurate way to put it. It's taking impure water and moving it to a much more pure state. So you really just have H2O without any other foreign bodies in the liquid.
Yeah. So one thing you could do, for example, is boil the water, collect the water vapor, and then recondense it down, but leaving behind everything that either has a higher boiling point or, you know, would not rise with the steam. It would just precipitate out like the minerals. So. Yeah, so I agree. A lot of the papers you'll see on it use the term demineralized water because it's a little bit more specific. So you say distilled is a little vague in terms of exactly what process is used.
But the question here is it dangerous to drink this water, or can you live off of that type of water?
You know, the answer is yes and no, depending on how you look at it. Distilled water itself is probably not harmful. It is just water. So there's two potential problems with demineralized water. The big one is that you're not getting the minerals that's in the water. Calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, as well as other trace minerals. So, you know, living off of mineral water, spring water, is better than trying to live off of distilled water because you probably will be deficient in these mineral micronutrients. There's certainly nothing healthy about distilled water. So, you know, you will see some claims out there that drinking distilled water is good for you. That is not true. If you're concerned about contaminants in your water, then, you know, you can get filters for those contaminants. That doesn't demineralize the water. The World Health Organization has a pretty thorough document on demineralized water, and they raise a lot of points, some of which I was not aware of. So they talk about the absence of the minerals that are actually good for you that you want to get in there. But, demineralized water is actually more chemically reactive because the minerals stabilize, you know, the water molecules to some extent. And they also tend to stabilize certain toxins. So demineralized water will, leach more heavy metals out of pipes and whatnot. So there actually have been cases of, for example, lead poisoning from using demineralized water with lead pipes, for example. So ironically, there may be more contaminants in demineralized or distilled water because the demineralized water is more reactive. It's going to leach more stuff out. And again, it also the minerals may tend to neutralize some organic toxins that may find their way into water. And without the minerals, you know, those toxins will have more of a negative effect. What distilled water or demineralized water is useful for is putting in your iron, for example, or putting in your dehumidifier. All right. Well, thanks again, Nick. Joining us now is Mark Krislip. Mark, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Mark, you are famous, or perhaps infamous, for your
infamous
Quackcast podcast, which I love.
And thank you.
You are a fellow blogger over at Science Based Medicine. And was it about a year ago that you said to me that you're in semi-retirement, or you're ratcheting down your practice and you're looking for work to do?
Well, not so much that I'm ratcheting it down as that my practice is ratcheting down on its own. So I have a little spare time to drive myself crazy with a new idea.
Yeah. So like me, you decided just to take on a new project to make yourself even busier than you were before your day job started decreasing. So tell us about it.
So my feeling was that, you know, I've been involved in skepticism from an intellectual point of view probably since I was in high school. I started reading the Zetetic back then. And over the time, large quantities have become sort of old hat. But I think that over time, issues of science-based medicine have become underrepresented in the skeptical and in the world for the amount of morbidity and mortality they cause. And part of the problem is that the medical field is not organized. It's the old thing, especially with doctors, as you know, is it's like trying to organize cats to get them to go places. And I thought that we really need, despite what the success we've had with science-based medicine, is an organization devoted to science-based medicine that gives us some power and some focus and hopefully some money to do things and to help support science-based medicine. So over the last year, I have written a website, and with the help of Jan Bellamy with the legal stuff, we have started the Society for Science-Based Medicine, which hopefully will someday rival the JREF in its power and awesomeness.
I think that's a reasonable goal, but I think we need to shoot even higher than that, Mark. I mean, I'd like to rival the Bravewell collaboration or anything that's out there that's on the other side. I mean, there are organizations that have millions of dollars to put their thumb on the scale, you know, to donate to academic institutions to have them start centers for complementary and alternative medicine, for example. There are many, like the anti-vaccine movement is well-funded to the tune of millions of dollars. You know, Brzezinski, the cancer quack from Texas, manages to find people to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to lobby the FDA to allow him to continue to practice, you know, his nonsense. So we need, if we're going to combat this, we need an organization that's huge.
No, I would love millions. I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime, but that's part of the purpose of having an organization is long-term goals.
Yes.
I mean, I'm looking at 10 or 15 years, not quick turnaround. And, you know, the problem we have is that all the work done in science-based medicine are done by single people doing single tasks. And when they retire or die or become dispirited, the tasks disappear with them and everything has to be recreated anew. The nice thing about organizations is there's continuity. And as probably the second oldest practicing doc in my hospital, I've come to appreciate, having been there nearabouts forever, the importance of having continuity, of knowing how things used to be and mm-hmm. why you don't have to repeat the wheel for things. I think that's real power with organizations as well.
Right. So the Society for Science-Based Medicine, it's an international organization, and it's for anybody. You don't have to be a physician or a healthcare professional to join. It's for anybody who wants to join to be part of the team, a worldwide collaboration of people to fight pseudoscience from infiltrating and destroying medical care.
And we got really lucky, too, because Stephen Barrett donated the content of his Quack Watch to us to mm-hmm. use as the basis for a wiki. And mm-hmm. I've been slowly converting it from HTML to wiki language. And there are thousands of pages of fascinating little stories in there besides the major things that we will hopefully collate for other people over time. So we're going to have a really powerful wiki at some point in the next year.
So is that your goal, Mark, is to make an actual medical wiki?
I have a bunch of goals. I want to have a wiki that is related to science-based medicine, and the Quack Watch material is going to do that. I want to have a yearly national meeting, a basis only covering science-based medicine. Hopefully it will be CME accredited. Those are my two really big goals up front. Then I know Jan has a lot of more legal/legislative goals that she would like to do. I tend to be more education-oriented by nature rather than advocacy by nature. But I would like this to be the premier sort of consumer site for all things concerning science-based medicine. Blogs, wikis, podcasts, conferences, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. My goal is big.
No, yeah, there's just an endless stuff that we can do. And I think that getting organized absolutely is the way to do it. The science-based medicine blog always was just a start. I mean, that was never the end. That was just always, we need a place to publish, to get a name for ourselves and to get out there. And we've done that. And I do think this was overdue, mainly because we're all busy. You know, so it was really awesome that you decided to take up the mantle and to do the heavy lifting for this particular project as part of our overall goal. So, you know, God, thanks for doing it. And it is awesome because I never would have had the time to do this. You know, it's like one of those things on my list of things I should do that I will never have time to do, you know?
So I have a bunch of those.
Yeah.
Guys, how much of a footprint has science-based medicine made over the past few years?
It's hard to say, but it's very highly ranked if you search on pretty much any relevant topic that science-based medicine covers frequently. You know, an SBM article will usually be in the first page, even when it's not like my own personal contaminated Google search. I know like Google fine-tuned searches to you, but if I go to a neutral computer that I haven't contaminated just to see how it's doing, it ranks pretty highly. You know, we get good contacts from journalists. So I think we're having a pretty good impact.
I like it when it pops up in places like, you know, they reference you in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, other major, you know, media sources have referenced science-based medicine over the past few years. It's a very, very big step.
Yeah, we're getting there. You know, I talk to residents and other doctors how little the internet plays in these things. I think people who do the net are still a real subculture, not a dominant culture for things like science-based medicine. My kids are on texting all day long, but they don't actually, if we were on Reddit, we'd be doing much better, or Snapchat.
Yeah, I mean, there are tons of social media opportunities, and that's always something that's, again, something that's difficult to keep up with. Like, we're trying to tweet more regularly from science-based medicine, but, you know, mostly we're a bunch of physicians, most of us still working. I think only among all the regular contributors, I think only Harriet Hall is retired.
Yeah, I think that's true.
The rest of us are, you know, maintaining day jobs, which is no small task, because, you know, Mark saying he's in the midst of a busy flu season, right?
Oh, yeah, it's been bonkers out here.
Out here is Oregon, I guess we should say.
Oh, yes, out here is Oregon.
Yeah, and you're an infectious disease doctor, so you care about things like the flu.
H1N1 has come back this year in my community. Like, it hasn't for a couple of years. It's been interesting.
Although it's still part of the flu vaccine now, right?
Yeah, it's still in the vaccine. I don't know why it's come back. I mean, we got 40 patients hospitalized in my system with influenza, almost all H1N1, and we didn't have any for the last 2 years. So it's going to be interesting to see how the virus has changed or whatever occurred to make that happen.
Mark, do you know at some point during the year, during flu season, if the vaccine actually was a success that year?
Most of the studies you look back show that if you get the vaccine, how you have a wide variety of different ways to measure efficacy, 50% protective. It depends on the population and blah, 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 blah. But overall, 50% of people who get the vaccine, 50% fewer people will get the influenza if they get the vaccine.
Hey, another quick question. So, Mark, if you got the flu this season, but you did not get the vaccine yet, is it still a good idea to get vaccinated?
Yeah, because there's three other strains in the vaccine that you'll get protection from.
Do you guys want to hear a bit of good news?
I do.
So we've been talking occasionally about Stanislaw Brzezinski. He's been in our crosshairs at Science-Based Medicine for a while. He's the Texas cancer quack who treats patients with anti-neoplastons and has run afoul of the FDA recently. Well, yet again, the Texas Board of Health has started proceedings investigating Brzezinski for making false health claims. In the United States, physicians are licensed by the state. The FDA can't take a doctor's license away, but the state in which they practice can. So it's good that Texas is yet again going after his license, but he slithered away from that process before. So, you know, this doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to come to anything. But perhaps now, you know, we've achieved critical mass in terms of the pressures against Brzezinski, and something will, something will finally happen. So we'll keep you updated on that, but at least it's moving in the right direction. All right, so Mark, so why should people join the Society for Science-Based Medicine?
Because with organization comes power and the ability to make change. And
so first you get the power, right? Then you get the money, and then you get the women. Is that the right order?
You should get the women first, because they're like 50% of the population could really help your cause.
That's true.
Not what he said in
the movie, women
though.
Are powerful, Steve, so you got to acknowledge that.
I'm quite satisfied with my N of one with my wife, so we can. I'll pass on that one. Okay. But otherwise, yeah. But you make change and make the issue important to people. And organizations have the power to do that that individuals do not. I think Eugenie Scott showed that very nicely. Mm-hmm. She's my other sort of role model with this in her organization, because she started small and now with a focus. And it's been a very effective organization. I think that's a good model to.
You're talking about NCSE.
Yeah, National Center for Science Education. Yeah, she did a great job with that.
Yeah, she started small and slow, and now it's a powerhouse.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. That's a great role model. So if you want to support science-based medicine, you can go to sfsbm.org.
Correct.
That's the website that Mark built himself. And there's a Become a Member link. You could click it, and it'll go over all of the wonderful advantages of becoming a member. But just knowing you're going to be part of this vast international organization looking to change the world for the better, I think is value enough.
That's a good goal.
Yeah, it's a pretty good goal.
Make the world a better place by the time you die?
Yeah.
I think that's a good goal to aspire to.
Hell yeah.
So, Mark, thanks again. Thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Thanks again for doing the heavy lifting and getting this organization off the ground. The memberships are already rolling in, I understand.
Oh, yeah. We're doing really well. I'm surprised at how well we're doing.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody who's joined or even registered. You can register for the site and participate and get access to all this stuff, or you can become a member and actually pay money. But you can still participate in everything without paying money.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mark. We'll keep everyone updated on how it's going, but thanks again.
I'm heading off to the Blazer game with my son, so
go
Blazers.
Have fun.
Thanks, Mark.
Awesome job, Mark. Hi, Mark. Thanks.
So before we go on with science or fiction, we have an important announcement to make. Registration has now opened for Nexus 2014.
Hooray!
Yay!
Yeah.
So April 11th to 13th in New York City. It's a Friday to Sunday weekend conference, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, co-hosted by the NEST, the New England Skeptical Society, and the New York City Skeptics. It's been running for a few years and, you know, quite an excellent, successful conference, skeptical conference. This year, our keynote speaker is Lawrence Krauss, who's always enjoyable. We also have Katie Coleman. Paul Offit's coming back. Paul is awesome.
Cool.
Elise Andrew from I Fucking Love Science is going to be there.
Yeah. Awesome.
Sally Sattel, Allison Gupp, and the usual cast of characters, Jamie and Swiss, Massimo Pigliucci, Heather Berlin, who was there last year as well. She was awesome. Very excellent. George Robb will be there, and the entire SGU. Last year, this was our only live event where all five of us were present. Probably not going to be true in 2014, but it might be for this part of the country. So the SGU, like at such conferences, will do a live show from the stage, and we'll also be doing a private recording that you have to register for separately. And I understand it's already halfway to being sold out. So if you want to attend the private recording, I would sign up quickly.
This year, it's at the Fashion Institute of Technology, FIT, again, as it was last year, which is a great place. Excellent venue. I really enjoyed that place.
Yeah, so guys, come check us out at Nexus. It's in New York City. It's an incredibly good time. We do a lot of other things other than the conference as well. We have
workshops.
Skeptics in the Pub. There's workshops on Friday. The live recordings, just lots of cool things going on, so we'd love to have you there. And if you're a listener, please come and say hi to us, because we're going to be at our table and we're going to be everywhere in that conference. So just, you know, feel free to come up and talk to us.
Yeah, speaking of the workshops, I'm actually doing two workshops this year on the Friday of the conference on critical thinking, how to be a critical thinker. So one's going to focus a little bit more on the science of critical thinking, and another one sort of as a practical guide to using it every day. And of course, if you are an SGU member, you get a discount on your registration. I emailed the code to all of our members. So if you are a member and for some reason you didn't get it, just shoot us an email and I'll give it to you directly. But you should have gotten it in an email from us already if you are a member.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Do it.
Yep.
Alrighty. We have an eclectic group of items this week.
Oh, Rebecca hates themes.
I don't know if that's a theme, yeah, but that's...
I think that's the sort of theme I would prefer.
The theme is there is no theme. The theme I hate themes.
Hodgepodge.
Potpourri. Is that what they have on? what do you call it?
Yeah, Jeopardy.
Jeopardy. Jeopardy. All right, here we go. Item number one. A new study suggests that cleaning bills could save currency producers billions of dollars a year. Item number two. A new study finds a significant correlation between the location of premature rupture of membranes, water breaking early in pregnant women, and the presence of bacteria. And item number three, scientists examining mutation rates in humans, chimps, and their lice find that their DNA mutation rates are remarkably similar. Jay, go first.
So the first one about cleaning bills could save currency producers billions of dollars a year. That's a tricky way of putting that, because were you saying that it could save them billions of dollars of actual, like, budget money, or billions of dollars worth of billions of dollars of paper currency? I'm assuming it's billions of dollars of paper currency.
It'll save them from having to spend billions of dollars a year. So of budget money.
It costs billions of dollars a year to maintain a country's currency? Or is this every country?
This is worldwide.
Okay. Well, still. Wow. Okay. All right. So now back to the idea that they have to clean it. Like, cleaning the money will actually, make it last longer. So then the question is this paper? Is this coin, or is it both?
Well, I said bills.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So cleaning paper money, it helps it last longer. Okay. I don't know, Steve.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
All right, so I really, I don't know what could dirt and oil, like, wear away the paper and make it, you know, not last as long. You know, people handle it, their hands are dirty, we all have oil on our fingers. No, I guess so, as long as the cleaning process by itself isn't bad for the bills. Second one, new study that finds a significant correlation between the location of premature rupture of membranes and the presence of bacteria. Wow. So bacteria could be eating away at the membrane there. I could see how that could happen. I think that's perfectly cromulent. And the final one, the scientists that are examining mutation rates in humans, chimps, and their lice to find that their DNA mutations rates are remarkably similar. Really? Nice try, Steve. Yeah, so the lice that lives on humans and chimps mutates as fast as the people do. That's pathetic. That one's definitely, absolutely the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Hi, Jay.
Bob, I have no idea. I can't have one comment on any of these. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, the clean bills, I'm not seeing that one. I just don't know why a clean bill would last longer. I mean, they're not paper. They're more linen than anything else. They're more of like a fabric, which is one of the reasons why they're so strong and so durable. I just don't know why a dirty bill, you know, bacteria, I guess, could be found on them. Lots of other weird things like cocaine as well. I remember reading that they did a study and found cocaine on lots of different bills, but that really is not going to degrade it. I just don't know. I just can't think of a reason why a dirty bill is a short-lived bill. And the second one as well, I have no clue. It kind of makes sense that the presence of bacteria could somehow prematurely cause a woman to have her water break early in pregnancy. I guess The third one, the mutation rates, humans, chimps, and lice, that kind of makes sense to me because I know that humans and I guess chimps as well have had a close relationship with lice for quite some time, and it kind of makes sense, I think, that if they are going to maintain this the relationship that they have, that you know, if one species is somewhat, you know, is mutating at a certain level, that the other one would as well. Is that a symbiotic relationship? Not sure.
It's a parasitic relationship.
It's parasitic. Yeah, there's no mutualism going on between. I guess not.
Do you like your lice, Bob?
Yeah, right.
Do you like your lice? Oh God. So that one kind of makes sense to me, and of course I could be totally wrong about it. So the one that I've got the biggest problem with, I guess, would be the money. So I'll say that's fiction. Damn it.
Okay, Evan?
I'm having a problem with this money one as well. The cleaning of bills, unless you have a process for not wearing the bills out further, you know, the cleaning of it would make the bill wear faster, wouldn't it?
That's a good point.
Unless you have some sort of dry cleaning procedure, it could depends. Unless you're going to dip it in a vat of chemicals or something, but I don't know.
Who the hell's going to clean it too? Yeah, well, clean your money once a month, but no one's going to do it. Nobody.
Yeah, you know, you go conventional, you throw a bunch of it into the washing machine and the dryer. I mean, all that, you know, friction and stuff has got to wear the bills down. I can't believe that.
And we've all done it. We've all done it, and I think the bills look a little bit worse for wear when it comes out.
That's my feeling.
And granted,
as well.
It's harsh. I'll shut up now.
It's the currency. I think the currency is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Man, the currency one makes total sense to me. Complete sense.
No, it doesn't.
Like, first of all, it doesn't even say U.S. bills, so it could be talking about like that cool Australian money that goes through the wash with no problem. But second of all, it also doesn't say what type of cleaning. It could be like one of you mentioned dry cleaning. Well, why not? Maybe there is like a sort of chemical bath that they've come up with that could clean bills. That's one of the reasons why they tried to get the dollar coin into circulation in the U.S. because it costs so much money to use bills, because dollar bills are so often handled and
they wear out.
They just fall apart. Yeah. So yeah, that one makes total sense to me. So for me, it's between the other two. I think Bob has a good point about lice and humans and lice and chimps evolving in concert. To me, it'd be really surprising if that one is the fiction. Water breaking caused by bacteria, that also makes perfect sense, but I mean, that seems like maybe that's just a little too obvious, and so maybe the result is something surprising, like that there's no correlation. So I'm gonna be the only one. I'm gonna spread out the votes here, and I'm gonna say that the premature rupture of membranes and the presence of bacteria is the fiction.
Okay, so we have a split across all three. So I guess I'll therefore just take them in order.
Okay.
Item number one, a new study suggests that cleaning bills could save currency producers billions of dollars a year. Bob and Evan think that one is the fiction. And that one is, you know, I was surprised that none of you went for the laundering money.
Oh!
Please.
Just saying.
I'd like to say we're all above that, I know that that's not true.
Think about it.
Clearly didn't think of it. Anyway, that one is...
Say it.
Science.
Oh, you bastard.
Sorry, Bob and Evan.
Crap.
Yeah, so worldwide currency producers spend $10 billion a year replacing worn-out bills. Nearly 150 billion banknotes every year are replaced. 150 billion bills, not dollars. Yeah.
Oh.
And that amounts to about 150,000 tons of old bills
being shredded. I think they burn. Yeah, they shred them.
Yeah.
What a job, man. Just slip a few $100 bills and old ones in your pocket.
Can you imagine that?
I guess
every
you'll never
day,
get that job.
There are stacks of money. Yeah, I've seen videos of them doing it.
Throw it into the fire.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, yeah, anything that we can do to decrease the turnover rate of bills, which varies from about 3 to 15 years, depending on the denomination. So, as Rebecca was saying, $1 bills are handled the most, and therefore they have the shortest life expectancy. Yeah, so they accumulate oil, bacteria, dirt, but specifically they get a buildup of human oil from skin, and that results in a buildup of what's called sebum, S-E-B-U-M, which oxidizes and turns the bills a yellowish hue. What happens is when bills are being processed by banks, you know, they're being sorted and counted by banks, the sorting machines will automatically remove any notes that are too destroyed or too dirty. And then those get, you know, put aside and are flagged for being exchanged for crisp new bills, and they're going to be destroyed. So what the researchers did was they showed that using supercritical carbon dioxide. Bob, did you ever hear of that?
No, not that specifically.
Yeah, so it's CO2 that's like in that phase between, it's like a gas and a liquid at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It acts like a gas and a liquid. And it's used commonly as for cleaning applications because I guess it's very reactive. So they, by treating the bills that are going through the sorting process with this supercritical CO2, it removed, so they gave like for, as an example, it removed 4% of the weight from a strap of 100 banknotes. So that's a lot. You know, 4% was not made of bills, but was made of sebum and dirt and oil.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, and they showed that fewer bills would be filtered out and flagged for destruction, you know, would be removed as too dirty to put back into circulation. They also show that it does not damage the fancy anti-counterfeiting measures like holograms or whatever. They survive the process. So yeah, it's more gentle than putting it accidentally through the wash, Bob.
Yeah.
Using the CO2. All right. Let's go on to number two. A new study finds a significant correlation between the location of premature rupture of membranes, which we refer to as PROM, right? PROM, water breaking early in pregnant women, and the presence of bacteria. Rebecca thinks this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science.
That's correct.
And this one is science.
Ooh, good
job, Jay, with the solo win.
Jay, again. Yeah.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Jay has 100%. Unreal. Everyone else has 50% so far.
I have 0%.
Oh, Rebecca's got zero. Sorry.
0%.
She moves from second place to third place.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
So, and I was careful to say a correlation because the study did not demonstrate that the bacteria was causing the rupture, but that it was just the locations have more bacteria. So yes, there's bacteria everywhere, but there's more bacteria in the locations where the ruptures occur. They also showed that the membranes are thinner there. All right. So all of this means that scientists examining mutation rates in humans, chimps, and their lice find that their DNA mutation rates are remarkably similar is fiction.
Jeez.
Because
I was off on that one.
What the study found was that the lice rate of mutation is 14 times faster than humans and chimps.
Does it have to be?
Well, this is what they found. So it would not be implausible either way when you think about it, because if it is, as Evan says, if we're talking about just the molecular clock, right, just the background random mutation rate, there's no reason why it wouldn't be similar. But in fact, when you look across various species, scientists have found that there's a lot of variability in the spontaneous mutation rate. And there's various, it also varies by gene as well. What they did with, this study, which is interesting that this is not the first time that researchers have done this, looking at parasites and their hosts to look at mutation rates because, like, for example, humans and chimps split at the exact same moment that human lice and chimp mice, lice did. Because the lice live their entire life cycle on their host. So there wouldn't be any exchanging, right, of human to chimp lice. Or at least it wouldn't be significant. So you could say that it's an opportunity to know that, like, chimp lice and human lice share a common ancestor at the same moment in evolutionary history as humans and chimps do. So that you can therefore compare them. And even though they're lice, they share a lot of the same genes with humans and chimps. You know, a lot of the basic cell structure kind of stuff, you know? So they actually, the researchers looked at 1,534 protein coding genes, only protein coding genes, across the genomes, and found that on average, the lice mutation rate was 14 times faster than in humans or chimps. And this has been shown before that parasites tend to have a faster mutation rate than their hosts. Not really clear why. So, Jay, good job, man.
Well, thank you.
That puts a lot of pressure on you to keep it up.
Yeah.
Or it lets me, you know, screw up a couple of times and I don't have to worry about it.
Are you going to coast already? Two right answers and you're already talking about coasting?
I didn't even say, we did not discuss coasting here.
I'll even get the next six wrong. It'll still be just chance. I mean, yeah. That's pretty good.
You'll still be doing better than Rebecca is now.
Shut up. Shut all your faces.
It only takes a few weeks before we lose track. So, you know, this is the beginning of the year.
It's fresh in our minds.
Yeah, we get to joke about it. All right, Jay. You're still the quote master. Give us a quote.
Okay, so I do have an offbeat quote this week sent in by a listener named Jimmy Rossland, who is from Australia, who is actually originally from Sweden. And this is Ingmar Stenmark, who is a Swedish alpine skier. And the quote is, "I do not know anything about luck. Apart from that, the more I practice, the luckier I get." Ingmar Stenmark!
So, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
My pleasure,
sir.
See you guys.
Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.